Today we talk to filmmaker Craig Gillespie about his new film, Lars and the Real Girl.
And she said, it's really good. I said, seriously? And she's like, yeah. And she's been a really tough critic over the years. So, in fact, I think it was the only script she'd read that she liked. And it was boggling to me that it was about, with this premise that she actually liked it.
Hey, I have a visitor.
Where did you meet this person?
I met her on the internet.
Yeah, well, everybody's doing that now.
This is Robert Davis. One of my favorite movies from last year was an American independent film called Half Nelson. And it's great for so many reasons. And I'm not much of a prognosticator. I don't make a lot of predictions, but I was hoping that all the people involved in that would go on to great things. So I've been on the lookout for filmmakers Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, a new actress named Sharika Epps, and probably the most visible person in Half Nelson, the lead actor Ryan Gosling. Now, Gosling's been in a lot of things since then, and nothing that I really got too excited about, including his new film, Lars and the Real Girl, which when I saw the trailer for it, I thought, well, there's one that I can skip. It's about a guy whose new girlfriend is a doll. But that was before we talked to filmmaker Craig Gillespie, and hearing him talk about his new film made me kind of curious about it. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Let me start with a general question of how you got into directing movies.
Very slowly. Yeah. It's not easy. There's no easy way to get into it. And you see these like directors that come from everywhere, acting, writing. I was trying to get a film for probably like 7 years. This film, I came across the script 5 years ago. And then I was working on other projects as well. And we could get no traction on this whatsoever. I mean, this has always been a passion project for me. But being a first-time director, it's such a finely tuned script and such a fine line that it walks, that nobody wanted to take that chance. Everybody appreciated how good the script was. I was actually even on like Hollywood's, number 3 of unmade scripts in Hollywood. But they just couldn't take that chance with a first-time director. And so until I got over that hurdle, and then we managed to get some traction on this.
Mm. Now, you are an award-winning commercial director, I know. How has making commercials prepared you for making feature films?
They're quite different animals, but the one thing it helped me hone was my sensibility of humor and just how to explore that with like the framings and the music or the lack of music. And working with actors, I mean, it's something that I started, really enjoying in commercials and really using them as the primary tool. But once you get into a film, the process is so much deeper and so much more exhausting in a way to really make the characters work for, 90 minutes or plus. It's very unforgiving. It's like I don't play golf, but I kind of equate it to one bad hit and the whole game's over,
So there's a lot more pressure than in making a film.
There is. And, but it's a lot more rewarding in the sense of the amount of backstory and the amount of work we could do on these characters and developing them from what Nancy had written on the page, which was fantastic. But then working with these great actors that all came in with so much enthusiasm and so much preparation on their own characters. They all managed to, elevate it.
What did you think of when you first read the script? Because it's such an unusual script.
I was attached to a bunch of stuff at the time, and my wife actually picked it up first. It was a family friend of ours, John Cameron, who produced with the Coens for 12 years, that sent it over. And she picked it up after a couple of weeks. I was just so entrenched in so many other things. And she said, "Have you read this?" And I said, "No, I haven't had a chance yet." And I sort of dismissed it because I knew the log line. And she said, "It's really good." And I said, "Seriously?" And she's like, "Yeah." And she's been a really tough critic over the years. So, in fact, I think it was the only script she'd read that she'd liked. And it was boggling to me that it was about, with this premise that she actually liked it. So I picked it up and I read it. And it's the only script that I've read that I could so clearly see what the tone of the movie was and what the town was. And how to portray these characters, and that sort of incredible balance that Nancy had of humor and emotion. So, ironically, it was always struck me as strange when people say, "Well, it's a really fine line to walk," because I so clearly saw it. I think more now after I've done it, I realize It's such a fine line.
And that, for me, was, I think, one of the most impressive things about the film is this consistency of tone. You know, because if you don't ride that line, you know, it falls one way or the other. It could be disastrous. As you were shooting, were you still kind of conscious of having to keep this tone?
You know, it's very much so, but I sort of fell into one very simple formula, which is we just had to believe that what Ryan and Lars as a character were going through was believable, and then go on that emotional journey. And I realized that however funny or not funny the film was fine. It was just, as long as we were invested in his character. And Ryan took so many courageous choices that just, in my mind, it made us more and more invested as we went along. And he just kept raising the bar that way.
Can you give an example or two?
We did so much discussion about, for him as a character, he's just in a love story. This is not a doll. And so constantly it's like, well, what is their relationship? What are they going through? Why are they arguing or not arguing? And so, you know, as he figured that out, he would have endless ideas of how to play a scene that made it much more complex and interesting. And, you know, like one idea was he wanted to sing to her in the woods, which wasn't in the script. The teddy bear scene where he does the resuscitation, you know, was an idea that he had. And just the fact that he talks to Bianca, the first scene we did was him arriving at the party. And he's pulling her up the stairs. And from talking about, you know, him having these discussions with her all the time, he said, I feel like I should talk to her. I think, you know, this is the first time she's meeting my friends. And she's probably really nervous. And so he came up with this idea about, you know, talking about people love to hear their own name. It's their favorite word. And that was his own improvisation. And it worked great. And from then on, I said, you know what? Talk to her as much as you want. And he does. There's so many scenes where he's throwing dialogue out to Bianca that's not scripted.
Oh, that's fantastic. How did the casting of this film go?
Ryan signed on immediately. Once I'd done my first film and then people were asking what I was doing, I actually just said Lars and the Real Girl like it was written in stone. It was nowhere closer to being made. But the first thing we did was send it off to Ryan Gosling on a Friday. We sort of sat down and discussed who could be possibly the best actor for this, and it was Ryan. He came in on Monday and said he wanted to do it, which was, I mean, usually you wait 4 months and they say no, you know. So it was an amazing response from him, and we sat down and talked. We sat down and talked first, and then after our discussions, he agreed. But
did he want to get a sense of what you were going to do with it?
Yeah, he had some very specific questions about how I was going to play certain scenes and the respect that I'd have for, you know, I guess his character, and also with the relationship with Bianca.
Mm-hmm.
And once we saw we were in sync, we just went for it. Mm-hmm. The other characters. Emily was always the first choice, and she's just such a beautiful blend of humanity and humor and warmth. It was just so she, you know, it just took a little time to juggle her schedule. And then for Paul Schneider and Kelly Garner, they auditioned, and it was a really interesting process. And I don't think I would have arrived at those characters without auditioning.
How so?
Well. A lot of the brothers we were looking at came in, and they were sort of emotionally stunted, but they were kind of more quiet and were there for him if they needed him, but didn't know how to express it.
Okay.
Paul came in and was just pissed off, which felt like such a real family environment,
mm-hmm.
that's the way he directs his emotion. And yep. That, you know, and it was such a refreshing way to look at it. And I hadn't thought of it. And once I saw Paul do it, I thought, that's great. Let's go with that.
Mm.
And the same with Kelly. It's like a lot of the women were playing it a little more fragile and timid and meek and a little more in the same energy as Lars.
Mm.
And then she came in and was just full of energy and bouncing off the walls and completely unpredictable. And you could see how Lars would be attracted to that.
Yeah.
And how, as an audience, you'd want him to be attracted to that.
That's right. Because it's important for us to realize early on that that this is going to come back around.
I know. As we were looking at audition tapes, my wife, at some of the performances, she said, well, you know, with those darker performances, she said, if you go with that, you feel like, you know, Mago at the end will order a male doll and the four of them be really happy together. You know, with Kelly, there's a chance they'll make it out of there.
Yeah, that's right. Can you talk about the rehearsal process? Because it sounds like there was a fair amount of at least modifying of things as you went along.
Ryan, see, we don't necessarily rehearse. We just do a lot of discussion about where his character's coming from.
Yep.
And just, you know, to inform him in that sense and vice versa. So we just really analyze what his character's going through. Paul and Emily, we got to rehearse, which was great. And I love what they actually got to bring to it, which, again, was their idea that there's more, they have more conflict going on throughout the film than maybe what was on the page. They make up earlier on the page, and they felt that was too soon. So that argument keeps going, and I think it really helps fuel all the relationships and why Emily ends up, you know, having that argument with Lars later in the film. So that was a great choice, and that was something, you know, that we tried in rehearsals, and it was fun to see come to life and really help the tension of the film, I think.
Yeah, I agree. How important was the sort of the cold winter setting for you?
It was waiting 6 months important. much to the pain of the studio, I think, because I kind of insisted. I mean, it was written into the script that there was this transition from winter to the spring and the, you know, life and rebirth, and that was sort of a theme through the film. And so I really felt it was necessary that we have that barren landscape. And then on top of that, it didn't snow, so then we had to get fake snow.
You guys shot in Ontario, right?
We shot, Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does the setting do for the film besides sort of add backdrop?
Well, it just reinforces his loneliness and his isolation.
Yeah.
And I think Ryan said actually that somebody mentioned to him like all the great love stories happen in the wintertime. And there is something about that if you think about it.
Why do you think that is?
I think it reinforces this need of longing for people to want to connect, I think. And it's like in the wintertime does tend to be when people are most alienated from each other.
Yep. It strikes me too that, and one of the things I like about the film a great deal is as unrealistic as this situation is.
What do you mean?
Yeah. the emotions are incredibly realistic, right? It's not a standard romantic drama, romantic comedy where, you know, you can almost predict Love Boat style when things are going to happen.
Right.
You know, there's a realness to
but
that.
Love Boat was a reference.
Well, how was Love Boat a reference?
Not to do.
Exactly. But and so for me, that was I was very conscious of my own emotions as I was watching the film because, you know, when he takes out the doll and then he starts to talk to the doll and treat it as if it's a real person, I remember thinking, oh, well, this is a tightrope act that's going to be hard to follow. And
for
so
another
I was,
hour.
Well, and I was but then as time goes on, I just found myself not thinking about that anymore. I became so involved in the characters, and I became so involved in the story and what was going on that it's not that I lost track of the fact that it was a doll, but I lost track of the fact that it was odd.
Well, I think because Nancy's written a script that then becomes so much about the family dynamic and about how Bianca coming into this world it forces everybody to face some hard facts and grow. You know, and that's the journey. It's like Bianca, to me, has always been a conduit in the film. You know, until she turns up, people know what's going on with Lars. They just don't know how to deal with it or access him. And as soon as she turns up, they have that access. And it also ends up making them have to look at themselves as well.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, there's a reference to Don Quixote in the film.
Uh-huh.
Where he can you talk about how important that allusion is?
You know what? It's like to give credit where it's due there. This is like an example of Ryan just always being so involved in the character. It's like that scene on the page was, you know, Lars looks through the doorway and sees Karen's pregnant belly. So then, which is sort of what's great with Nancy's script is she leaves this, space to make choices here. And so we're like, well, what is Ryan, you know, what is Lars doing up there in the bedroom? Are they playing Scrabble? Are they, you know, and then I say, I think maybe he's just reading. And then Ryan came up with the idea of Don Quixote. And thought that would be a great, you know, metaphor for what's going on in the film.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, you know, to to have him look, it's like he had the idea that Bianca is like looking over there, and that's what catches his eyes. So what became a very simple scene on the page became this really sweet, touching moment.
Yeah. And for me, that was a real touchstone for the film because, one, it's subtle. You know, it's not telegraphing it to the audience. It's not saying, hey, look, we're reading Don Quixote. Make this, you know. And yet, once the Don Quixote reference is made, it's like, oh, of course that's what's going on. You know, it's and the film became a much fuller experience for me. And part of that's because I love the novel. But two, to sort of see Lars's character in some way as Don Quixote fashioning his reality. And then other people coming alongside of that, as happens in the end of the novel, I just thought was fantastic.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, in that sense that all this is very real to him.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's really all you have to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, because his emotions are real then,
yeah,
and what he's experiencing.
Was there any pressure to make the ending more explicit, you know, to sort of resolve certain plot threads that are unresolved?
None whatsoever, which is quite bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain... And it's funny, I said to Nancy when I read the script, I couldn't imagine it going any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it took her 4 months to figure out that ending.
Mm.
It just, she was stumped on that. And maybe I shouldn't be saying that, but anyway, I think it just seems so organic to the journey. But what I liked that was on the script was that there was something somewhat ambiguous about what's happening. And I wanted to keep it that way. And it was something Ryan asked about in our first meeting. And I said, I love that there's some choices that the audience can make, and neither choice is wrong. It's really just how you feel about it. And I've seen people, when those questions have come up, they argue profusely for their for their point of view.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, there's no right answer there.
Mm.
It's what you think, you know.
And you didn't get any sort of the studio asking you to sort of say, let's have the birth scene, strangely enough.
They were so supportive throughout this whole process, and I think they really appreciated the balancing act that was going on, and that they had to at some point relinquish the reins there.
Yep.
But you know, they were working with a great script, and what was great with that sense was that they let us run with it, and they let us try things, and they let us experiment, and there wasn't any repercussions to that.
It's
pretty rare.
Yeah, because I read an interview where you said it was like being back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Is sort of that what you're referring to, this lack of interference?
Yeah, it's like, you know, we couldn't shoot in continuity, for instance, but when we were in the pink room, we had to shoot all the scenes in the movie like, over the course of 4 days, and that's on a location. So it was literally myself, Ryan, the DP, the camera operator, and the sound guy. That's everybody that could fit in there for 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so crowded and tight that Ryan wouldn't even bother leaving between setups. He would just sit in a corner, and then we'd reframe and adjust and move Bianca and shoot the next scene. You know? And it wasn't any, you know, it was just this little nucleus that we were in and just exploring that character. And it wasn't like having to run over and check with some executives and be like, oh, we changed the script. Is that okay?
Yeah.
It just felt what was right. For, you know, we really, Ryan has mentioned in it, and I think it was true. With every scene, we learned more about Lars and what felt right for his character. And so we kept learning about him through the scenes, and that would inform the next scene.
And as the movie goes on, the audience learns more not only about Lars, but about his environment, you know, about this society, these people that he lives with. And we come to understand him more because of how we're understanding the people around him more.
Really?
I thought so. I'm a sucker. So I live in a big city, and I love living in a big city.
Right.
But I have this soft spot for movies about small towns and small communities. And so
I'm from Australia. But my wife is American. She grew up outside of Philadelphia in a small town kind of environment, which I drew a lot from, as you know, with this film, in terms of locations and characters and wardrobe. And you know, it really helped that I had that perspective.
Interesting. I have to ask this question. A lot of reviews of Lars have sort of they start off by saying, and this is the same director who did Mr. Woodcock, and there's this, this amazing shock. And I'm wondering, have the critics, are they right to be surprised, or is there for you an underlying consistency between the two movies, or are they just completely different?
They're quite different, but I think there's a sense of me in both of them. I mean, they're just different beasts.
Yeah.
You're dealing with one, which is this sort of large machine of a big studio comedy, and is a lot of fun in its own right. But that's a different kind of animal to the small independent character driven thing. You know, doing a studio comedy, it's all about the punchline within a scene, and that's the holy grail. And this is actually the opposite of that. You're avoiding punchlines.
And what kind of movies do you hope to make in the future then?
I actually loved this process on the last one. So for me, it's finding anything that I can dig into a character with an actor. I don't know what genre that'll end up being, but it's really about that and exploring the characters and not quite knowing what the outcome's going to be. You know, that was what was great about this. It was such a collaboration between myself and the actors and the DP and the editor, and it's like everybody brought stuff to the table.
Mm.
And that's what was fun about it.
I always like to end with a question. That's a bit odd.
Should I ask the question?
Well, that would also be odd. What kind of movies do you think the world needs now?
That's a little too philosophical for me. I think maybe what's sort of been a surprising side effect of this film is that I didn't realize there's so much dark film going on at the moment and dark content. And this is ultimately an optimistic message, which I think is actually helping it in a way. It's so refreshing for what's around the world at the moment. And I think there's, it's about the innate goodness in people, which you just don't see much of these days. And it's there. It's just not talked about.
Oh, well, thank you, Craig. That's great.
All right. Thank you.
For more information about this podcast and other episodes, you can find us on the web at erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. If you have feedback for the podcast, you can email us at feedback@erratamag.com or give us a call at 415-287-4020 and leave a digital voicemail. A quick note, if you heard our previous podcast about Abbas Kiarostami's film Homework, which showed recently at the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley, well, you know that the print that they screened there was severely edited from the original version, and we're not exactly sure why. But a listener from France recently reported that at a Kiarostami retrospective that's going on now in Paris, they showed this same edited print. So if you have any information about this or know what's going on, leave us a comment at erratamag.com/podcast. Scroll down to the Kiarostami episode and take a look at that thread there. We'll be back next time with more stuff. Bye.